From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A two-day conference on the danger of nuclear terrorism at The Hague Monday. Daniel Dickinson reports.
World leaders are gathering in The Hague in the Netherlands on Monday to discuss progress in preventing nuclear terrorism. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is due to address the opening session of the two-day Nuclear Security Summit, attended by over 50 leaders. The summit is aimed at ensuring effective global cooperation to prevent terrorists getting hold of nuclear weapons or material. The first Nuclear Security Summit was held in Washington, D.C. in 2010, following a speech made by United States President Barack Obama warning about the dangers of nuclear terrorism. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
Meanwhile, the leaders of the G7 group of industrialized nations were expected to hold talks in The Hague early Monday evening on the sidelines of the Nuclear Security Summit to discuss whether to expel Russia from the group of eight as punishment for its actions in Crimea. We have this report from NHK World.
Leaders of the G7 industrialized nations will discuss whether to expel Russia from the group of eight as punishment for its actions in Crimea. They will hold talks in The Hague on the sidelines of a nuclear security summit. U.S. President Barack Obama arrived in the Netherlands. He had called a meeting to consider the group's response to the crisis in Ukraine. The leaders are expected to discuss their support for the Ukrainian government, as well as possible further sanctions against Russia over its annexation of Crimea. They're expected to consider removing the country from the G8 and go back to the G7 framework.
Europe and America are united in our support of the Ukrainian government and the Ukrainian people. We're united in imposing a cost on Russia for its actions so far.
Some European countries that have strong economic ties with Russia are cautious about imposing severe sanctions. Analysts say the attention will be focused on whether the G7 can agree on a tough stance to prevent the Ukrainian situation from deteriorating even further.
We'll have more on U.S. and EU sanctions against Russia later in the newscast. The U.S. National Security Agency has reportedly hacked into systems of Chinese technology company Huawei. The New York Times and German magazine Der Spiegel said such activities began in early 2009, citing documents leaked by former U.S. security contractor Edward Snowden. We have this from the Chinese news agency CCTV.
The National Security Agency operation, codenamed Shot Giant, appears to have been a successful effort to hack servers in Huawei's ultra-secure headquarters in Shenzhen, China. This gave the NSA the ability to monitor the communications of the company's top executives and more. One of the primary goals? To investigate alleged links between Huawei and the People's Liberation Army. The US Congress later conceded that it found no evidence of such a connection. The suspicions were the subject of a US House Intelligence Committee investigation 2 years later, which also involved rival Chinese firm ZTE.
Huawei and ZTE provide a wealth of opportunities for Chinese intelligence agencies to insert malicious hardware or software implants into critical telecommunications components and systems.
The Intelligence Committee concluded that there was no evidence to back up claims made by its chairman, Mike Rogers. Huawei, which is one of the largest telecom firms in the world, has been seeking a bigger commercial footprint in the United States and fought back against what it rejected as unfounded allegations.
It would be immensely foolish for Huawei to risk involvement in national security or economic espionage.
A leaked NSA document shows that U.S. agents also wanted to exploit their penetration of Huawei's security systems to gain access to intelligence from countries such as Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Kenya, and Cuba. The German magazine Der Spiegel also alleges the U.S. spied on top Chinese officials, including then-President Hu Jintao.
In a statement released to CCTV, the White House says it can't comment on specific intelligence collection activities, But it goes on to say that the collection of intelligence related to foreign trade secrets is authorized only to protect the national security of the United States or its partners and allies, and not to gain commercial advantage. Daniel Rentsch's CCTV, Washington.
China's Deputy Foreign Minister Hong Lei expressed concern about the U.S. spying.
我们对有关报道表示严重关切。
China expresses grave concerns about this situation. China has lodged solemn representations after media reviewed strong evidence showing that the U.S. has intercepted, monitored, and spied on China. China again demands that the U.S. stop such spying activities and formally respond to it.
The timing of the disclosure could make the visit to China by First Lady Michelle Obama awkward. She arrived last Thursday with her mother and two daughters for a week-long tour of the country. On Saturday, before the disclosures about the NSA program, as she addressed college students in Beijing, she said that open access to online information was a, quote, universal right, closed quote. And the disclosure was another complication for her husband, President Obama, in his talks with China's President Xi Jinping Monday afternoon on the sidelines of the nuclear summit at The Hague. Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes said Xi raised the matter in a private meeting between the two presidents, and that Obama told Xi the U.S. does not engage in espionage to gain commercial advantage, but rather makes a clear distinction, quote, between intelligence activities that have a national security purpose and intelligence activities that have a commercial purpose, closed quote. Thousands of people took to the streets of several countries in South America this weekend. In Argentina, they were demanding an end to U.S. interference in Venezuela. We have this report from Press TV.
Argentinian demonstrators staged an anti-U.S. rally to condemn what they call Washington's interference in Venezuela's domestic affairs. Protesters gathered outside the U.S. embassy in Buenos Aires, accusing the U.S. of plotting a coup against the Venezuelan government. Demonstrators also demanded an end to U.S. interference in the Latin American country's affairs. Venezuela has been gripped by deadly protests since early February. Caracas accuses Washington of sparking the unrest in Venezuela.
And thousands of Brazilians reportedly took to the streets in Sao Paulo for the third time in recent months to protest against the upcoming 2014 World Cup tournament scheduled to kick off in June. The demonstration was focused on the construction costs of the stadiums and the poor conditions of public transportation, with critics saying the millions of dollars being spent on the event should have been invested in better health, education services, transportation, and housing for Brazilians. The protests have raised security concerns ahead of the games, with federal troops being deployed after Rio State Governor Sergio Cabral held emergency talks with President Dilma Rousseff to request army support for the Rio Police Department. Rousseff has said, however, that her sympathies are with the demands of the protesters. And in Chile, there was a demonstration Saturday in the capital, Santiago, to show support for President Michelle Bachelet as she follows through on her campaign pledges to address constitutional reform in areas such as social inequality, free quality education, and free health care. The so-called March of All Marches demonstration also called for changes to the Constitution addressing the issue of autonomy for indigenous territories. Protesters said the march was not against Bachelet, but was intended to show government officials that Chileans intend to see their demands met by them. Saturday's demonstration was the first protest since Bachelet took office less than 2 weeks ago. It is also the biggest political protest in the country since massive student protests against the previous center-right government in 2011. Organizers said the protest attracted some 100,000 people, with police estimates of at least 25,000. Student protesters said they did not take part in the demonstration. They've been working with President Bachelet on an education reform package that will soon be sent to Congress. Bachelet succeeded conservative Sebastian Piñera in the election of December 2013. Her campaign promised to finance education and health care with higher corporate taxes and to fight social and economic inequality in the country. The 62-year-old socialist is serving a second term as Chile's president. She previously held office from 2006 to 2010 as the country's first female president. She enjoyed an 84% approval rating when she left office, owing in large part to her use of government reserves to help the poor in the country. Meanwhile, across the Atlantic in Spain, discontent was on the march, literally. Protesters converged on the capital, Madrid, on Saturday, arriving on foot by the many thousands. They were demanding an end to mass unemployment in the crisis-hit nation, where at least 6 million people are out of work, and anti-austerity sentiment is running very high. The March for Dignity drew marchers from all regions of the country. RT's Egor Piskunov was there and filed this report.
They've been walking by foot since the 9th of March, covering hundreds of kilometers, coming from different towns and villages across Spain, under the rain, under the sun, and now they're entering the final stretch before their final destination, the Spanish capital, Madrid. But let's find out what drove some of these people to take part in this march and to walk so many kilometers.
Hello, sir. Why are you here?
Why am I here? I'm sick of this government, with all the promises they never fulfilled. They said they were going to create more jobs and lower the taxes, but it's a lie. Instead, unemployment rose from 4 to 6 million. This is the only way we can fight back.
I left my home last Sunday and have been walking since then. We are united. We need better health, better education, and more jobs.
What caused you to take part in this march?
There are too many reasons. My sons have to walk every day from 8 in the morning to 5 the next morning for only 400 euros per month. Also, I am a teacher, and I know what cuts in the public sector mean. All these evictions, this is insane. I'm marching to Madrid because I can't walk to Berlin or Brussels. We must stop them and the Troika.
So clearly all these people have different motives to take part in this march, to walk so many kilometers, but they do have one unifying them objective. And earlier we met with one of the organizers of this march during a break that they took just a little bit earlier. Here's how he explained what they're trying to achieve.
What the government wants is to go back to the Franco years and keep the working class from demonstrating in the streets and saying what our main problems are. We won't allow that to happen, and they know it. Here we are in Madrid. We came to say that this government has lied to us from the very first day. This government and the one before presented themselves with a political agenda that has never been enforced. They say they'll do one thing, but actually do the opposite. We are fed up with all these lies. We also came to say that they have to go, that we will change this system from the bottom to the top, and all the workers in the streets will achieve this.
This is only one of the columns which has been taking part in these marches all these days, since they've been advancing towards Madrid pretty much from the entire country, from all sides. Igor Piskunov, RT, reporting from Spain.
As the U.S. and South Korea held joint military exercises and North Korea tested short-range missiles in a drill of its own, with each side accusing the other of provocations, early Monday, Ri Tong Il, Deputy Permanent Representative of North Korea to the United Nations, offered a background briefing addressing some of the issues between the two sides and pointing out that the U.S. drills interfered with a family reunification effort that was well underway.
Thank you very much for your participation. I'm very happy to be with you. And I'd like to draw your attention to the development of situation on the Korean Peninsula, and would like to clarify the position of the DPRK. As you know, there has been a positive move on the Korean Peninsula. Last February, between the North and South of Korea, high-level talks was held successfully, and it was followed by separate family reunion gathering in the Korean Peninsula. This move, although it was the minor first step, but it is significant in the meaning that it gave rise to great pleasure to the entire Korean nation, and it gave rise to greater expectation of the entire Korean nation towards wide open dialogue, easing of tension and relaxation, reconciliation and unification of the country. With regard to the positive move, the international community expressed welcome, sharing the pleasure with the Korean nation as its own pleasure and success. But on the other hand, regrettably, only the United States did not share this pleasure and did not respect this positive move, but rather it did not hesitate to move into provoking the DPRK by opening the gunfire of joint military drills on the Korean Peninsula. And at the same time, the United States is hell-bent on widespreading the so-called provocation and threats of somebody else in order to escape from the responsibility for the aggravated and increased tension on the Korean Peninsula. And furthermore, it is stepping into expanding new hostile policy against the DPRK. In this regard, first, I'd like to introduce the generous and strenuous efforts of the DPRK government towards easing of the tension on the Korean Peninsula, North-South relations improvement, and towards security and peace of our nation. Coming into the new year 2014, our supreme leadership in the New Year address made a warm appeal on improving the North-South relations, make historic new turning point towards reunification of the country and towards securing and safeguarding security and peace of our nation. Upholding the supreme leadership warm appeal, the National Defense Commission immediately advanced 3-point crucial proposals to the South Korean authorities, and it was soon followed by another sending of open letter to South Korean authorities, to all political parties and social organizations of South Korea. Coming into February, the DPRK did not hesitate to accept the request from South Korean authorities on holding the separate family reunion, although in view of the harsh winter condition and the political environment, it was not mature yet. But one thing to remind again is that before that, the DPRK side in the crucial point clarified first and foremost as one of the proposals the question of creating favorable climate for improving the North-South relations. And it took first step towards stopping full-scale slandering the other side. So it was one of the very important proposals made. And it was also in the crucial proposal clarified the issue of making full stop to all military hostile activities against the other. As clarified in the proposal, the DPRK went ahead making stop of our military acts, which can be interpreted as provocation and threats by the other side, in particular in the area of a full length across the military demarcation line, including the 5 islands of hotspots in the West Sea of the Korean Peninsula. And all these activities are just representative examples which the DPRK has taken, and these steps are in good reflection of the genuine position and unchanged position of the DPRK government towards having dialogue between the North and South of Korea, bring about reconciliation and national unity and national unification of the country. Second, I'd like to brief the reaction from United States towards the crucial proposals advanced by the DPRK. As soon as these crucial proposals was advanced, the United States went into escalating provocation against the DPRK and intentionally increased and aggravated tension on the Korean Peninsula, totally rejecting the crucial proposals advanced in January. The U.S. openly stated that there will be no change in their policy towards the DPRK. And the planned joint military drill will not be altered. At the very moment when the representatives of the North and South of Korea were sitting together at the table of dialogue to discuss the issue of separate family reunion, which we boldly accepted the request, the U.S. made another provocation at that time by flying over into South Korea, the nuclear weapon carrying B-52 strategic bombers, thereby creating another nuclear blackmail against our nation and undermining the climate of change towards relaxation. At the very moment when the separate families were sitting together in the Mount Gumgangsan, which is a very beautiful mountain of Korean Peninsula, in our side, and it is called the Diamond Mountain, and they were sharing the pleasure of reunion of blood relatives and family members. But the U.S. again did not hesitate to enter into provocative military drills against the DPRK without any show of respect for this move, and again pouring cold water on the move towards easing of tension and reconciliation.
It was 15 years ago Monday that President Bill Clinton announced the beginning of what became a 78-day bombing campaign against Yugoslavia over the right of the breakaway Republic of Kosovo to be independent. Živadin Junaković is the former foreign minister of Yugoslavia. He says the U.S. and NATO have two standards of international law, one for themselves, the other for the rest of the world. He spoke with Radio VR's John Robles this weekend.
Can you tell us your opinion on the situation in Crimea? It has now become part of the Russian Federation, and the correlations you see with what happened in Kosovo, in Serbia, and Yugoslavia, in particular with the hypocrisy of the West?
Yes, we understand that Crimea had been part and parcel of Russia, and the referendum and vote of the people now has opted for a reunification with the motherland. The West obviously reacts to suit own interests and not to respect any principles. We are faced with another example of double standard policy of the West. When the Kosovo and Metohija separatists, Albanian separatists led by terrorist organization, proclaimed separation, independence of Kosovo and Metohija, the West immediately supported this decision and immediately recognized independence of Kosovo and Metohija, claiming that it was a unique case and that Albanian national minority in Kosovo and Metohija had legitimate reasons and a legitimate right to secede from Serbia. when we said it will be precedent and it may backfire in Europe and elsewhere in the world, they say, oh, no, no, it is a unique case. When President Putin in Munich in 2007 said it is not a unique case, of course, it was not a unique case from the very beginning. We claimed it was a precedent, and it will backfire to stability and the situation in Europe, because we know that there are many separatist movements in almost every corner of Europe, not to speak about Africa, Asia, Latin America, and so on. It has become really quite clear that the Western powers have one universal criteria. That is that any event, any claim should suit their interest. Anything that suits their interest is proclaimed to be in accordance to international law, in accordance to democratic principles, in accordance to human rights, and so on. You see, when they interfered in internal affairs of Yugoslavia in 1998, in 1999, in the year 2000, and so on, they said, well, sovereignty and territorial integrity have lost their classic meanings. Now, with the integrational processes in Europe and elsewhere, borders do not have a very, very essential meaning. So those years, they pumped hundreds of millions of dollars in so-called process of democratization in Yugoslavia. Actually, this was financing opposition in Yugoslavia and trying to bring so-called democratic opposition of Serbia to power. They could not do it so simply. They actually had to militarily intervene. And they practically have stolen the Kosovo and Metohija from Serbia. And later on, they have installed democratic opposition in Belgrade, forces which would respect Western interests. And ever since then, up to now, the authority in Belgrade is characterized to be pro-Western. But nobody to really say, how about that these authorities be pro-Serbian? They are not characterized pro-Serbian, but pro-Western. And they keep continuity in always helping structures which will take Western interests as national interests. In Ukraine, we saw something similar. They pumped about, I understand, $5.5 billion. What for? For democratization of Ukraine. And obviously, they did not accept, they were not accepting pro-Ukrainian government. They always have tried to install, to bring in power pro-Western government in Ukraine. And actually doing this, they have destabilized one of the largest European countries. And now they act like being surprised about the crop that they have from seeds that they seeded in Ukraine. Well, in 1999, we had a precedent blueprint which was followed later on in overthrowing legitimate governments in many other countries which conducted independent policies. And all this NATO aggression in 1999 against Serbia and Montenegro, against then Yugoslavia, had been a turning point toward globalization of interventionism and a turning point toward expansion toward East. They have pursued this policy of expansion regardless on the interests of Russia and so on. And when you react, how about decisions, how about agreements, they say the privilege of the West is not to respect even signed agreements.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.